This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome back to TVI. Carl Donnelly here.
Julian Dean.
This week's episode.
Hi.
Hi. We're joined by comedian, ex-circus. I say ex-circus performer, but he still does sort of circus shows. I'm sure he does still does juggling stuff. Martin Moore. He is a lovely chap, funny man, globetrotter. Like, I've gigged with Martin all over the world. We've been in we've done all the Australian festivals together over the years. So we caught up with him. We talk quite a funny chat about his fashion sense.
But he's about testosterone replacement therapy.
Testosterone replacement therapy. It's an interesting
None of us are on it, but we do talk about it.
Yeah, we just thought, let's discuss
not
it.
Trying to sell it.
Imagine that. That was our merch, guys. Get on you in
TRT injections once a week.
But that's it. Listen, enjoy. Thanks for all our patrons who've signed up. If you want to sign up as patron, it's patreon.com/wearetvi. You get little bonus episodes where we do sort of catch-ups. New feature we've just decided we're going to be doing is going forward. We're going to just record a little extra bit with our guests, just a tiny little tag on that is for
just
patrons
for you guys.
Only. Because sometimes I do think, you know, we speak very freely, I think, and we tend to get our guests to. But sometimes on Patreon, we'll drop a name that we might have kept back in the ep. So
we'll bolt that on the end, mate.
You know what I mean? Little them little bit extra bits that will go on Patreon will be if there's anything that feels like it shouldn't be aired to the general public. So there we go. Anyway, that's enough of that. Enjoy us chatting to Martin Moore.
Lift off.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to TVI. My name is Carl Donnelly. I don't know what
And my name is Julian Dean.
And we're joined by comedian. Would you say sort of circus performer, globe trotter, Martin
Juggler.
Moore.
Hello.
Hey, hello. Mate.
Squatter. As in the weights.
Well, you know, I actually used to be an actual squatter. So in the 80s, when I was in Belfast, squatting government-owned buildings was very fashionable amongst the arts community.
Oh, I saw you on the news a couple of days ago at Capitol Hill.
Yeah, we're trying to do more. We're going to turn it into a vegan collective.
Well, we were talking, before we hit record, we did talk about how your look could be described as, and not for any, but you predate it, you've been doing it forever, but yeah there was definitely some people, you know, nicking podiums and shit that looked a bit like you. Big beard.
I could 100% just fitted right in there.
Well, like sort of you wear a lot of what's the word, like utility clothing, you know. You're a fan of a cargo short. That's because of your globe trotting and outdoors lifestyle.
Yeah, it's exactly how I buy things. So when I buy clothes,
would this be good to sort of launch a coup against the government?
Would this be good to overthrow the government?
I am. We've talked to somebody about cargo shorts. I'm sure it's been, like, I've got a real aversion to any utility clothing. You know, I like to wear sort of, because that's because it's not my style. But I think you're one of the few people I know who it suits, because it suits your look. What I don't like is seeing a middle class dad in Queen's Park near where I live with fucking cargo shorts and a North Face fleece and hiking boots when he's literally just gone to the farmer's market. That shit does my head in. I don't mind if somebody, you are somebody I think wears it for the right reason. Sorry, Julian's just got coronavirus. So that's all. He's also just disappeared off screen. Julian, have you died?
I'm all right now. I got over it quite quick.
it was that new strain that passes through.
But, resilient.
But in terms of, because you'd normally be over it. Would you normally be in Adelaide around this time or heading over to Perth and that?
No, Perth. So Perth starts, the Fringe World Perth starts this weekend.
Fuck.
So I would normally have been there for the, either I would have been there for the week before, or often I go and teach at a circus festival, a Western Australian circus festival. So yeah. I could have been there since just after Christmas.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, it's weird. It's very weird. This will be my first Northern Hemisphere wonder for five years.
It's because we've done Adelaide together in the past, haven't we? What was that year we were both nominated for a Chortle Award while in Adelaide? Do you remember that? Yeah. We found out and we were at the festival club.
Yeah.
That was weird. That was a bit, yeah, it was about, that was like 2013, 14 or something.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's bullshit, all that stuff. Isn't
I
it?
Know. I remember we couldn't have given less of a shit. Like, you know, that it was a Chortle Award and a lot of, you know, not, and this isn't a criticism of comedians that are interested in that sort of stuff, but we genuinely didn't give two fucks. Like,
yeah.
I suppose we were on the other side of the world, so we were out away from it all. But, like,
yeah, you know,
I was getting loads of messages of, like, congratulations, mate. And I was like, I don't.
Yeah, some guy's blog is going to give you a prize.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Right? I don't mind Steve from Chortle.
He's friendly, isn't he?
Yeah, he's nice anytime I run into him. I know, but some comedians have a real hatred of anyone that reviews comedians. But I just don't have any interest in it. I don't read it, so it doesn't really bother
me. There's something a bit weird about the job they do, I think.
What, reviewers?
Yeah, there's something, especially when they're quite egotistical about it.
I suppose you have to be. It's impossible to be there's no point being a totally objective reviewer, because you're not going to give any.
I know.
You need to give something.
It is their opinion, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think as long as they are open about it being their opinion, I think they're fine. Like, you know.
You know,
I think
the problem is that with comedy, like with alternative, what was alternative comedy, it's just that it's still too new that nobody ever became like an authoritative critic.
No.
You know, when you see a theatre critic, and some of them, like, they could be university professors of theatre stuff. And it's that none of them have ever became, there's never really any expert, is there? Like that Bruce Dessau, is that how you pronounce it?
Dessau, yeah.
Dessau, he seems very good. He's
a nice guy as well.
He is nice, isn't he?
I've said it on here before, the worst golfer I've ever played with.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he is, if I was to review his golf, it would be 0 stars.
Yeah.
And I would tell him to not do golf again. But he's a lovely guy.
Yeah, I think at some point there will be an actual comedy expert who's a reviewer, because at the minute it's
hard when it's an art though and not like a, I don't know.
I also think it's much harder to review than other things. Like if you look at theater is always sort of, you know, obviously there's fringe theater, there's sort of big budget, you know, it's big bloody West End theater, but you know, they're always of a sort of, you're in the same sort of place watching, like, you know, I think the big reviewers that will go and see all the big plays, they sort of, there's a standard form they're watching that's much more, things get a bit different and go towards the edges, but not, so how can you review, be a comedy reviewer, and 1 minute you're reviewing fucking, let me think, someone like Trigg V. Wakenshaw, who's a bloody trained clown and mime, who's doing a fringe show an hour, and compare, and then next thing you're watching, I don't know, Paul Tonkinson, who's a classic, straight down the lines, observational storytelling stand-up. How can you have the knowledge or expertise to like review both of those? You've got to have, it's all a bit too, I think it's all over the shop. And next thing you're watching a sketch group, and next thing you're watching, it's too much different shit.
I think it's evolving, but isn't that, because, so if you went and you compared Les Miserables at you went to see in the West End, there's a big show, or Cats, or one of them big shows, and then you compared something that was an alternative theatre type production in an arts centre or in a barn or something. So the people there aren't comparing the like to like.
No, not at all.
Whereas with comedy,
that's true.
They tend to do it like.
Well, that's the thing. Definitely, actually. Yeah, theatre reviewer, if they watch fucking a one-man sort of monologue about fucking sexual assault in a, you know, in this sort of Reddings. But they watch it in like a little arts centre in Reading. They're not gonna compare it to fucking, you know, the play that goes wrong that's on Shaftesbury Avenue.
You know, yeah, I think it's right, isn't
that? Whereas, you know, there is that thing, I think, of a reviewer will go and see a Hannah Gadsby show and it'll be, they'll be blown away by how honest and personal it is, and they'll be like, this is the most amazing, heart-wrenching comedy you could ever watch. And next thing they'll watch just someone just doing an hour of like, it's all booking my kids, right? And then they'll be like, how could they, then they've
don't
got to accept
to it, man.
They've got to accept they are so different, so you've got to review them from different places of your psyche.
I think Steve Bennett and Bruce Dessau are good at it, are on the good spectrum of what their knowledge and stuff about it, I guess. Eh?
My
issue, I think, is that when I first started, I heard about
you got
Chortle.
A bad review.
I got some good ones off of Bennett when I've had some good ones off of him, but
right,
so it's not like I've not got like a grievance, but it's more that I got really into reading every one of his reviews and trying to learn how to do comedy from his reviews.
That's your own fault for thinking you learn comedy from reviews of other comedians.
Or just thinking, oh God, do I do that? When he's criticizing something, oh God. And then you end up getting so into it as an open spot and tailoring what you do with a review in mind.
But I genuinely think that's the main issue with... I don't think there's any issue with comedy reviews. I think there's more issue with comedians reading comedy reviews. Why the fuck? I've never, you know, and weirdly, I think I know enough actors to know that in theatre, reading a review is a real big thing. They all read them, you know, because I think, again, if you're in a play, you're one part of a bigger thing. I can understand you wanting to know how good the thing you're in is and stuff like that. But if you're just a one person writing a show, I think you've got enough awareness of what you're doing that you don't need to read.
I haven't read a review. I honestly haven't read a review in 20 years. What I do is when I...
For the best, mate, to be honest. No,
definitely don't look at the Evening Standard today.
When I Edinburgh or somewhere where it's useful to have reviews, I have two mates, and they read them for me, they lift the quotes off.
Exactly.
They give me the quote. But you know, I saw a really interesting thing where we're talking about reviews. Really interesting. I've got some nice things that, you know, you get a review and you particularly like it, and you like the quote, and you keep that quote. You go, oh, that sums me up nicely. If somebody seen that on a poster, they would like what they came to see.
Yeah.
Like that. And I 2 years ago, I was doing one of the Australian festivals, I think it was Adelaide, Fringe, and they said to me, oh, we're only using reviews that have come from we're only using quotes on anyone's posters that have come from a big recognised publication within the last 2 years.
Oh, really?
I said to them, why is that? And the person I was speaking to said, oh, we don't know. And I said, you're forcing us all to play the industry game because then we have to be in the Times or we have to be in the Adelaide Advertiser or whatever.
And the reviewers might have put them on the spot with that, might have given them kind of ultimatums. Yeah.
Well, I think it's because they're worried about the thing now that people are looking beyond the established venues and they're looking for the fringe venues. And the big publications don't want to go because they want to sell you an advert, don't they?
Yeah, and it also doesn't bode well for the fact that, you know, like The Guardian, for example, like is one of the big publications. Their reviews over the years in Edinburgh has dwindled because their budgets have been slashed because they don't sell enough papers. So now it's not like 10 years ago where The Guardian review was a big thing in Edinburgh because they'd do sort of... over the festival, 50 shows, whatever. They probably only review about 6 shows at the whole fucking
thing. I think I heard,
thing.
So that, don't quote me. I don't know this if I'm remembering this right, but it was something like, in the past, The Guardian used to have 20 reviewers, and like a couple of years ago, they had one reviewer. So it's such, dwindled,
It's fine. I mean, that's print media's dead, in it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know a thing that used to happen, but with the stage, you know, the publication, and so the stage used to do a thing that they only ever did good reviews. So that if somebody saw something and they didn't like it, they just didn't publish that one. And they published them as recommendations of, here's what we think is good.
I'd like
that to be in comedy because
I would. What changed? They just saw the shows and thought, no, we need to warn people.
So I think I know exactly what's changed in general is that the people are no longer specialists at what they're doing across the board. And it's so much easier when you've watched four shows in a day. It's so much easier to write what you didn't like than try to understand what you did like. And with comedy especially, it's such a weird little, you know, the communication things and the way we're doing subliminal stuff. It's so easy not to understand why that was better than something else.
And the brain sometimes goes to things you don't like more than things you do like as well, doesn't it? It's just like the human condition, I guess.
Yeah. So I would say, as well, like in comedy, if it's a one person show, like stand up show, you know, if it's a theatre show and one person in the cast, like if it's a proper play, maybe a 6-person cast, if one of them's not feeling it that day, it's halfway through the festival, the fringe, you know, they're feeling a bit low, the other 5 can carry it, and that show could still be a good representation of the show that reviewer might see it, and it's pretty similar to what it will be on any given night. With stand-up, like, if you see somebody on the 3rd day, just when they hit their groove, and they nail the show, and they've got a lot of energy, and it's great. But if you see it 2 weeks in, they're a bit tired, they might have a bit of a lurgy from the fringe, you know, they might just be a bit fucking not feeling it that day. That might be the worst version of the show they do all month. So I think the spectrum of how good and bad a solo show can be is much bigger again than like a piece of
theatre. Oh, man, you're exactly right. So look, from all my time as working in the circus, I was nearly always, like I do solo shows, I still do solo shows, but I was nearly always in double acts or bigger. And it's exactly that. And there becomes, in a good double act, for example, a good juggling double act, if somebody's got an injury, which is really common with circus. So if I have an injury and I'm doing a solo show, it can really mess that show up. It's really good. But in a double act, you cover it and it gets covered and the other person's energy covers. So you're exactly right. The solo stand-up is the most exposed.
Well, because you're being like athletic and doing physical stuff, if you've torn your ACL, you can't do certain stuff, you mean?
Or just your movement's just a bit tighter, you know? You're trying to do what's already a difficult juggling trick and you've got a twingy shoulder. Well, it can throw you right off. But I think a solo stand-up in an hour is one of the most exposed art forms.
Yeah, definitely. That's why I say it's not worth reading them, because it's too sort of, it's too vast a spectrum of what could have happened that affected the review. But anyway, what we were talking before about Julian was saying he's been teaching maths. Before we hit record, we were talking about how we've sort of been passing the days now we're in. Because where do you live, Martin?
So I'm in on the Lancashire-Yorkshire border.
Okay.
We're in the countryside about.
The moors?
We're up in the moorland, yeah. So you walk out my garden.
Nice.
You walk out the back of my garden, you're in wild moorland country.
So you're quite near Brendan Dempsey, are you?
Brendan Dempsey, I don't know. Where does he live?
Brendan Dempsey?
Brennan.
Oh, Brennan Rees.
Brennan Rees.
You got both names so wrong.
I am quite near Brennan Dempsey / Brennan Rees.
Brennan Rees lives on the moors, doesn't he?
That's right.
Who's Brendan Dempsey again?
There's a comedian called Brendan Dempsey.
He's a big Irish comedian.
Very tall. I saw Brendan in, it's one of my early fringes that I went up. Do you know when they used to do the Comedians Theatre Troupe shows?
And
they did them on quite a big scale. I saw when they did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Christian Slater, he played the Jack Nicholson character.
I bumped into Christian at a meeting I was at, and he came and sat next to me while he was doing that. And he had a really big head.
Yeah, he looks like he's got a wide head, hasn't he?
His forehead, I mean, he looks good, but he sat next to me. We're both on the floor because all the chairs were
like
taken.
Looks like a cabbage patch doll, doesn't it? It's a big old moon face.
Garbage pal kid. He sat next to me and I was like, that's fucking Christian Slater. And he went, hey man. And like, apparently he just had this giant head.
Nightmare. Like during that month, apparently in Edinburgh, because because basically Brendan Dempsey played the Indian character, the Native American character in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which in what would be now a problematic role,
yeah,
but it was a different time. And Stephen Amos was in it, Phil Nichol was in it. It was great. I remember it was great. Yeah. But
Lucy Porter
was in it.
Yeah, Christian Slater was in it. No,
yeah, in Edinburgh, yeah. He did a run of it in Edinburgh with all those guys. It was fucking mental. I remember, like, I think I was. I don't know if I'd started stand-up. It was the year before I started that I went up to see what The Fringe was about. Like, when I just was doing open spots. But, but apparently Christian Slater was a fucking nightmare that month to work with. Apparently, he's like, you know, because he's a Hollywood star, even though he's not, you know, his star had waned somewhat in the 2000s. But he, he's at an arts festival in Scotland for a month. So he just went mental, like...
I saw him on the street. I didn't, at the point I saw them, I didn't recognize who he was. But I was walking along the street, and a woman walked toward in this direction. Two guys in front of me turned to look at her, and they did that thing that guys do when they're like admiring a woman, but they're kind of macho and they're showing their mate, "Oh, I like woman." Yeah, so they kind of both turned and were going, "Yeah." Like this. And as they're looking, she's one by, I'm looking at them. I just looked at these two guys and I'm just thinking, dickheads.
Yeah.
Like that. And then about a few days
then
later,
you saw her batty crease and were like, well, "Yeah, boy."
I got introduced to him as God, I got introduced damn. To the guy as here's Christian Slater. So I was going, "Hello, mate." Just thinking, "Oh, you're the guy I saw on the street being a dickhead."
I mean, True Romance is fucking classic.
Oh man, it is. Good. I watched it about 2 months ago. Like, it's the first time I've watched it in over a decade. And it really holds up well out of all that. There's a lot of those era films, when you watch them now, are a bit naff and shit. Mm. Especially the ones that try to be a bit quirky, like True Romance with the whole Elvis, you know, chatting to him. And some of it could have aged badly.
What's the one that your man, Christopher Walken, had to watch up his arse?
Pulp Fiction. Sorry,
Because
obviously,
yeah.
True
That's
Romance,
so good.
That Christopher Walken scene with Dennis Hopper is...
Oh.
It's amazing. Obviously, that now, like, when you hear the script, you're like, it's got that whiff of Tarantino. Just
it's
loving
so,
saying the
yeah.
N-word. But it's still, the acting in that scene is quality. Like, Dennis Hopper, you forget, is a world good actor, even though he's mental.
And there's so many levels. Like, he's sticking up for his son, and
he knows he's
going to
die. Totally.
So he just lights a cigar because he's going to die for his son. And he takes him down with him. It's like, yes, motherfucker. Even
amazing.
Though... Yeah, it's not that what he's saying would take someone down. It's that he knows that guy would be so
offended. Totally.
Yeah.
It's that
the other guy's the racist, isn't it? I guess.
Yes, but I think he's tapping into that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's an amazing. But the acting is incredible.
Yeah.
It's that thing. That is obviously. Yeah, that's a horrible. You keep saying it, but there were different times. But now when you watch a Tarantino film, some things like Django and like that, I do get it makes some of it makes me cringe. But I really like. Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Mm.
That's the first Tarantino film in years that I genuinely was like, oh, this is good. This is very like. It's really fun, actually.
Bruce Lee didn't come off well, though, did he? Like,
no, well, I mean, no. It was all because it's all sort of nonsense, isn't it? It's all just a pastiche of what that time was like. So I think he just, I don't think that was. I think there were some people upset about that, but it's like it's made up. It's a fantasy, isn't it? So, how good looking is Brad Pitt, man, in that film? Have you seen the scene when he's on a roof, topless, and you're like, this guy's in his 50s, and looks
dreamy.
Incredible. Like, you know, it's just
absolute smoke show.
But it is that, like, he's of a level.
The man's an 11, mate, innit?
Did you see, it was about a year ago, they came out that he's going out with a woman who's much younger than him. She's like sort of 30 or something.
Lucky girl.
And a lot of people went, you know, come on, it's a bit, at his age, he shouldn't be going out with somebody that much younger than him.
He should share with everybody.
But then it turns out she was also married, and she has a polyamorous marriage.
Oh.
And a lot of people are doing the
joke. I bet her husband loves pasting a bit of pit on her when she comes out. Sweet Jesus. Don't jump in the shower just yet, honey.
Just let it linger.
Just let the aroma marinate.
But I was thinking, like, you know, in terms of, I get that thing about, you know, sort of sometimes it's a bit creepy when old guys go out with younger women. But I think you make allowances for certain levels of guy. I think Brad Pitt's he's a Champions League man, isn't he? Like, the rules are different.
Have you heard this stuff that a lot of these in Hollywood are on human growth hormone, even though they're not for
TRT,
for the bodybuilding aspect.
Julian will be well into this.
Yeah,
I've never done it. I do know a little bit about it, though.
Makes you look younger, apparently. A little bit.
Julian's watched 800 hours of YouTube videos about it, so he doesn't.
Joe Rogan's on it quite a few things, and you can kind of see. I think it makes you. I don't know. He looks kind of a bit. His head is a bit big. There's a couple of acts I know that are doing it actually, and they really recommend it. But I don't know. Maybe when I'm 60 or 50 or
what's
or,
the benefits to
or
it?
30.
So apparently it makes you look younger.
It brings your testosterone level as you pass 30 as a man. Your testosterone drops.
Yeah.
Like each decade, sort of a percent. So that testosterone, you need to build muscle. You know, like when you see a 21-year-old with zero body fat, but they're still muscly.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it brings your testosterone levels up to when you were younger.
But what's the payoff? Because your body and everything in life is about balance. If something is suddenly getting boosted, something is dropping. Something is not.
The problem with it is that, you know, like bodybuilders overuse it. So when you have testosterone to a certain level, when you have a certain amount of it, then it becomes steroids. But you can get your testosterone levels checked. Even in Superdrug, you can buy the kit. Get it measured, see where it's at, and then have a little bit of TRT every week, and just to bring it up a bit.
But what I'm saying is, if you're bringing it up artificially, then there has to be a side effect somewhere.
The side effect is that it brings
if you're young, like a bodybuilder,
you stop making it, and you need to keep using it.
Yeah, but if you're older, they reckon this. I read a really interesting article about this that. So they reckon that maintaining it as at the level of being 35, if you maintain your 35-year-old testosterone level artificially, that people can do that for the rest of their life. They can
do it for
the rest of their life. But the thing is, I don't know the dosages of this stuff, but say the medical dose was 10, the bodybuilder dose is like 250.
Ooh. Like a ridiculous amount.
People abuse that. So,
but they have to in bodybuilding. They have to, though, don't they? It's like they're on stage with other people who are doing it. They wouldn't be able to compete without steroids.
I read a book about bodybuilders, and you know the bodybuilder Ronnie Coleman.
Yeah, he's fucked now.
Oh, he's absolutely.
Right, let me Google Ronnie Coleman.
Yeah, look,
he's the best ever, but he's fucked also. Like Dorian Yates.
Oh, I've seen this guy. I think I watched a documentary.
There is a documentary. Ronnie Coleman in this book said at one point that he was so big that walking, the weight of his muscles was hurting him because of the tendons.
Horrendous.
He's one of the when you see him interviewed, he's one of the loveliest guys, isn't he? He's so happy. Even he's like can't walk at the moment properly, but he's so positive and happy. But they say a lot of it because he was a power lifter as well.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is to do with the weights have you seen how heavy he was lifting?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just fucked his spine up.
Yeah. A lot of the bodybuilders weren't strong. Did you mention Dorian Yates?
Yeah. He's into yoga now. And you met him. You got a photo with him, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah. So when I used to do the gigs in Birmingham, like the Glee or Highlights in Birmingham, I always would get a day pass and train at the old Temple Gym, which is like one of the famous bodybuilder gyms. And Dorian was often knocking around in there. I say hello to him and stuff. And, you know, he's famous. He were a famous guy. So he's used to people saying hello. So I had a photograph with him. But once I was in there, it was in a basement. It looks like a dungeon. Like it's a famous old.
I've seen the video of him. It's called Blood and Sweat or something. But the gym looks brutal.
Oh, yeah. It was wild. In that gym, I reckon every single piece of equipment, had more weights than a standard gym has in its entire gym. But I was in there one day and I was using the, I was on my own, I was using the squat rack and Dorian Yates, and I didn't know it at the time, but it was his wife, Gina Yates, who's a bodybuilder, a professional bodybuilder. They asked if they could jump in on the set. So I'm waiting like standard 3 minutes.
I would have said, yeah, do you want me to take some weights off?
Well, do you know what?
I always do that joke.
Think of the
sometimes
pressure.
Sometimes people are like, what?
I'm in the squat rack. There's a mirror in front of you. So if anybody doesn't do weight training, standard form in a squat rack is there's a full length mirror in front of you. So you can see if you're doing it correctly. And just to one side was a life-size cardboard cutout of Dorian Yates when he was Mr. Olympia. So the cutout's like this. He's just a massive guy. And in the thing, I was squatting the same weights as his wife was squatting. He was putting the weights up quite a bit. And he wasn't even training. He was just doing it.
Warming up while he was there.
He's very famous for having... He only used to train 45-minute sessions, didn't he? Mm. But it was so intense that he, like other competitors would train with him and you'd see them in the car park vomiting. Yeah. He was renowned for having such intense sessions that no one...
You know the thing he says now that he thinks was the difference? In an interview I read with him now, because what he used to do was he would train that brutal, hard training. And then every afternoon after training, he would train, he'd have a nap, 90 minutes. And even if he didn't want to, he would lie down. I think he likes a bit of a puff.
And he's into ayahuasca and all that now.
Yeah, all of that stuff. And he reckoned it was being able to do that 90 minutes resting every day that made the big difference to it. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're in shape, you know, you've got, man.
You totally are.
But you're now sort of a big purveyor of getting fit in, you know, your later, because obviously you used to lift weights, but now you've got much fitter in terms of overall fitness.
Not especially.
In terms of like, you're much leaner than you used to be.
Yeah.
When first met you, you had somewhat of a belly on you. Let's be honest.
So I was a circus performer all my life. So there's obviously the training around that. And then I was powerlifting, maybe the last 15 years powerlifting. And then I got, so I was probably hovering around 16 stone, standard weight. And then I got a casting for Game of Thrones. Oh. And I bulked up. So I topped out at about 18 and a half stone. And I did have a belly. I was buying a lot of calories.
I could really see you in that show, man.
Yeah, you know, I never got the
playing Khaleesi.
I never got the part, and I never even went further than, you know, they do that thing. We'd love you for this. And then at the same time, this was 3 years ago, in July, I didn't get that part. I was heading towards Edinburgh, and it looked like I needed a hip replacement. And I literally just went, the specialist said, drop some weight and you might make this hip last a bit longer, you know, your natural hip. Yeah. And so I just dropped the weight, easily.
Yeah.
And now I'm about 13 stone. And they just the other day told me that they think I get another 5 years out of this hip.
That's so good.
Been a really positive result from it, because I think that hip operation's a pretty big do, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's...
What caused that, do you think?
I was going to say, what would be the cause of your hip issue?
Squatting, maybe, do you think?
Well, I don't know. So it could literally just be hereditary, couldn't it? I've got these spike... When you see the x-ray, you know, it's a ball and socket thing, isn't it? And there's spiky bits on the hip. But for me, that thing of circus performers, especially... I used to be the bass man. I used to be a juggler, was my job. But I used to also be the guy that got stood on in an acrobatic troupe. And you just can't do it. You just can't. That's not... All of my mates in circus...
I can't do this.
Well, nearly everybody's...
Get off!
Yeah, it's just relentless. It just ages you so quickly.
Yeah.
And that's why it's lucky. I think for me, the reason I'm still doing circus stuff is... So I broke my ankle. While I was off with a broken ankle, discovered comedy. Started doing comedy. Had to pick one or the other. Did comedy for 20 years. And I think that has allowed me this longevity as a circus performer, because I literally wasn't doing that with somebody stood on me every day, twice a day. So
bloody hell.
Yeah, a lot of circus performers get old really quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And what would they be doing standing on you? Like they'd be juggling or like acrobats and stuff. So
we had
light bulbs.
So we had it was a comedy routine, but yeah, it was basically that the end bit of the thing. They would do like flips and stuff. They were doing all their actual stuff. I never could do any of that. I did a couple of strength like handstand type things. And then the end of it was, it's kind of a standard thing. So there's two people on me and they've got two people on them. Out. And it's like a tree shape. It's like a pyramid shape and everybody, and it's only for a few seconds, it's that big finish to the show.
And how did you get into circus performing? When you were a kid, were you interested in it?
Yeah. So I was always able to do stuff like that. I was always good hand-to-eye coordination and dexterity. And then I was just really lucky. In Northern Ireland in the 80s, there was a lot of Arts Council funding. So there's a lot of funding. So in no time, in my
first... You just bought a big tent.
No. We did. That's true.
I mean, it's not what the Northern Ireland in the 80s was notoriously known for, but it's nice that there was a positive spin on something.
A bit of cash floating about.
Because of that, anything that was non-sectarian, because of the troubles, anything that was non-sectarian would get arts funding. So if you could do something...
It was either a tent or a claver.
So we got like Gollier came and taught us. So we got taught by Gollier.
Oh,
we had all the top teachers in the world.
Yeah.
Look, circus teachers. We had loads of them in Belfast.
Because just for listeners, they might not know that reference, but Gollier is notoriously the most famous clown and clown trainer. He's a teacher of clowning. And notoriously, like Sacha Baron Cohen talks about his time at the Gollier School in Paris.
Daniel Simonson trained there as well.
Simonson, I know loads of people.
What was his name?
Dr. Brown. Phil Burgers, who is probably one of his more modern, well-known students. But like, it's notoriously hard. You know, Sacha Baron Cohen talks about it like it was the thing he needed to do to find his how to be funny. But most of it is spent being told you're shit. Like every day you've got to go out and do stuff, and Gullier will just say, no, you're shit, leave me alone.
I did a clown course in London. I don't know if I spoke about it. It was so brutal.
I did a weekend with Lucy Hopkins.
I bailed out.
And I loved it. But like I did it just because she's a mate. And it was very gentle. She knew I was just going just out of curiosity, and I wasn't planning on becoming a clown. But apparently, Sacha Baron Cohen says, the greatest day, I think it was the greatest day in his life or something, was the day that he did something and Gullier said, today you were not shit. And he said that was like, that's what he needed to hear.
So he does a thing on in his workshops, Gullier, where he has a big moustache.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he's watching you, he was leaning on a yardstick, like a big ruler.
Yeah, yeah.
He was just leaning on it like this. And then we gradually started to realise that if he did this, it's because you were making them laugh.
Okay.
You didn't want to see laughing. But you know that thing about people go about it, how brutal it is and how hard it is. I think they've made a mistake here because people do Gollier now like they're doing a parachute jump.
And yeah.
It's like that. I give you an exact example. It's that people that are hard, that want to be a hard man or they want to come across hard, and they have tattoos to show how tough they are.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, they really hurt. And then you speak to other people and they go, did that hurt? And they go, no, it didn't really hurt at all. I like this. So the people that go on Gollier that want to do it as like a bravado or I survived.
Yes.
When I did it, me and my mate were a professional juggling double act, but we'd never been taught anything apart from the old fashioned circus stuff. We'd never been taught this modern stuff. So when Gollier went, you're shit, which he does do, he went, oh, that was shit. You go, I was just thinking, well, why wouldn't it be? I've never done it before.
Yeah.
I was so good. And
just
I
heckle
still...
slam him.
Well, look at that. But that's it. You know when it's that thing in.
Would you
comedy?
Like to whisper in a helicopter? You're fucking. Nice tash.
But that's more like, it is more like the reality, isn't it? You know, when we do gigs and the open spots are there and the acts blow smoke up their arse and go, oh no, you did great. You were getting you.
Yeah. It doesn't help anyone.
Well, they're not fucking babies, are they?
I agree. Like, actually, when I did that clowning weekend, I found it really help. I actually enjoyed it and found it much more helpful than I expected. Even though I went in very much just going, I'm just, I've got a weekend free. I might just do it because I, you know, Lucy, who runs it, is a very, she's a great, I think she did Goulier like years ago. She's been doing it for like, she did it 20 years ago or something. And she just, she is a professional clown and is brilliant. But I just, weirdly, I felt like I dealt with it much better than some of the actors and some of the other people that they brought a lot to it. And I think they were trying too hard to be funny, but I'm professionally funny and I have been for 13 years. So I didn't have, weirdly, I didn't have that insecurity that I'm not funny. I was like, I might be shit at this bit of it, but I know I'm funny in normal day to day.
That's exactly what we had. We had people come to the Belfast one because I think it might have been one of the rare times. It definitely was a rare time that he did it outside his own studio in France. And so we had people from all over the UK come and stay in Belfast and do the work in Belfast. And the actors, some of them were like people that I'd seen on the TV and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would really be like, when he'd be going, that's shit. They'd be, how can it be shit? I've done. And they were
just going,
what's the fucking point of coming if you're just going to fight against that? And
well, the thing is, the fight also comes from the very thing. Like actor, the problem I noticed with some people on this one I did, the actors were really trying to act funny rather than just be funny. Like, you know, that's clowning is about finding what's funny in you. That's not to get too pretentious. There's that old wanky saying, like, of finding your inner clown. But what it is saying that you can't, you know, you obviously in a comedy film or something, you know, a good script, a good actor can make it funny. But the best comedy actors, they're just funny. They're not acting funny. They're just funny.
And you're, I think, playing that's what it straight in a way, aren't you? Like, totally. Will, what's his name? Will.
Ferrell,
yeah, him, he's just playing, it's all in the character, isn't it, this kind of
he's just a funny man, he's got funny bones, I think that's with clowning.
You know what? I don't think that thing, you know, that thing that people say that, oh, they're just funny, I don't think that's always true, you know. I think
it's skillful,
they've learned.
Oh, there is that, you can learn to a certain degree, but I do think,
because if we do this, it's like, I disagree, man, I disagree. I think we're in an art form that's largely untrained with stand-ups, and certain people do well. But if you look at, let's say, for example, George Best, the footballer George Best, he also did...
Rubbish clown.
He also got really coached.
Terrible at stand-up.
He also got really coached, didn't he? And he really practiced and trained. And here's an example. Here, a better example is Alex Higgins, snooker player. And so everyone says the best natural player ever.
Yes.
And then he had a problem where it went wrong. And I believe he went to somebody like Ray Reardon or one of those other old school guys that's like a coach.
Yeah.
And they said they couldn't coach him because he didn't know what he was doing in the first place. Because he was natural. He was just a natural.
Yeah. So he hadn't learned because he's been so gifted. They kind of went against him.
And you know what it makes me think of?
Comedy.
You know when you get those guys that get up to do an open spot and they do really bad, and afterwards, and they go, "Oh, but I'm really funny with my friends. I'm the funniest."
I think being funny with your friends and being funny on stage are two totally different muscles. You know what I mean? I can only think of a couple of comedians off the top of my mind that I wouldn't say have any natural comedy in them, but they are just very good at writing comedy, and their lack of sort of performance and charisma is overridden by how good their jokes are.
So I think the
opposite is true. Most comedians are probably a bit funnier than their material is.
Yeah, but you know the thing that they do on stage is a learnt thing. So look, when you get up as an open spot and you're funny, you know, you get up, you're funny, you're an open spot, and then it takes you that time. So you say find your inner clown, and comedy would say find your voice.
Yeah.
It takes you that time to go, oh no, I'm just sounding like Robin Williams. Oh no, I'm just sounding like Billy Connolly. This doesn't seem natural. That bit there that they're learning in theater or in circus, somebody would help them learn that faster.
Normally,
I don't think it. I think the good people, the all of the really good stand-ups that I know that are really genuinely good, are also analytical. They're also analytical. You know when somebody comes off and they go, when they go, oh, that wasn't my crowd tonight.
Yes.
Yeah, and they leave it at that. And as
Julian's
if
catchphrase.
As if that's enough.
he's got a tattoo of it on his chest.
You're not my crowd tonight. It's a good title for an Edinburgh show.
Yeah, your closing line.
It really is.
That's my closer. You're not my crowd tonight. Thank you very much. Good night.
Yeah, I know. It's... I think it's 1% of the time a gig goes bad, it's the audience. You know what I mean? I've had dodgy gigs, but then watched, you know. I watched the person on after me smash it, and smashed it after people have.
That was an awkward drive back, wasn't it? Yeah. I think you learn.
But even that thing, Carl, when somebody does it, when somebody goes on after somebody's done badly, and we've all done this. You've been standing there, you've seen somebody do badly, and you'll go, it's that table in the top corner.
Is that
table over there? So sometimes I would then go on and I would address that table straight away. Yes. And that's the analytical thing we've learned on stage, isn't it?
It is easier to... I always think, if a gig isn't just dog shit, you know what I mean? Like, if it's well, decently set up, the audience aren't horrible, it's so much easier to have a good gig when somebody's just fucking laid shit
they want
on the stage.
It. They want it.
Their levels of expectations have been dropped so low that if you just go on and look confident and just be like, you know, they just suddenly just, they'll love you, man. I love cleaning up a mess.
It used to be, right? In my earlier days of comedy, so two things I think have really changed now is, one, you don't see people encoring very much. You don't see that as often as you used to.
We haven't worked together in a while, have we?
No, not a while, mate. But I used to always say, when I was hosting somewhere, I used to always say to the headliner, if there's an encore, do you want to do it? And I don't even say that anymore.
No.
And also the other thing is, you used to always see people getting booed off.
Yeah.
And often that would be the open spot or the first act.
Yeah.
And that thing, but of somebody could do terrible and somebody could do fantastic, it like stretched the whole possibilities.
Yeah, so much more.
It was so fantastic. And especially you'd see that, like it could happen, like literally, I could have a terrible gig and then go back to the same venue the next night and encore.
Yeah.
And it just was such a, that nothing
like gets
has.
I've definitely noticed that in my time of, I think, you know, I feel like I caught the end of, even though I didn't start in the mid 2000s, but I feel like I caught the end of the 90s almost, like, because there was almost like a change of 90s comedy. Then when the I think ended theoretically, like realistically, when the TV boom started in 2004, 2005, that's when the shift happened. And actually, I think since then, the circuit, I think audiences have actually got way not better, sounds like the wrong word, but I mean,
more savvier.
Because they watch loads of stand up on television. Yeah. So I think audiences now know that you sit there and you watch and you enjoy it and then you fuck off. Like, it's not,
I think
there used to be a bit more of a Wild West feeling to it where audiences felt that you could always get, you still,
they didn't
want to
sit
wire
in the front row and they think that they get taken the piss out.
It did, and also the style of like comparing has changed. You know, it did used to be much more. I remember going to like fucking the Banana and, this wasn't just, they don't have a compare, but you know, I was sitting in the front row with mates when I was 18 or 19 and it's one of my first ever gigs I went to, and Dave Johns ripped the shit out of us. And it was funny. It was embarrassing, but also it was fucking exciting. But that was what comedy was. And I think now people are so a bit more chilled and you don't want to dive in hard.
So. I used to say when I was hosting, so this is like, I don't know, 20 years ago, probably. I used to always say, as a way of being, as a way of telling them the rules, I go, oh, who's been to comedy before? And then I go, if you've never been before, please don't talk when the acts are on stage.
Yeah.
Now I never do that because it's such a small amount of the audience that I've never been before. There'd be like nobody that's never been before.
You just see much more discerning looks. Like, you know, now you see somebody talking in a gig and you see everyone around them just giving them all dirty looks. And like, I think audiences now expect it to be a show.
Yeah.
Which is, that's what I mean. The parameters have shifted. Like, I don't think there's I think the chance of that encore level of fucking madness has sort of died off just because it's
Well, so do you know, honestly,
down to a bit more in the middle, a bit more safe and a bit more.
If you ended up as a closer, you always had to have 40. You always had to be prepared that you were going to do 40 just in your set that you were going to do 40. And if you ended up doing over an hour,
Julian's worst
nightmare. That was no, that was no surprise.
You get encored at 20. At 20, he'd come back and do the same 20 again.
I got called for an encore once as an open spot, and Adam Bloom was headlining, but I don't know how it was happening. It was in Southend, but I had no more material, and I was saying no, and the compere was trying to pull me back on, and I said to him, "I've got no more." Yeah. It was horrible experience, but a nice humble brag.
I once saw a really brilliant thing. You know when you get those compares that are dickheads because they're being competitive about the night, want to steal the night.
They can try and fuck you up a bit.
And some famously, you know, we all know people that famously do it. One night in the Frog and Bucket in Manchester, the compere that was on was being a dickhead like that about Robin Ants. Right. And Robin, this is when Robin was just a club act. He hadn't done any of his science stuff. And he came back to the side, the compere, Robin's on, and he goes, "Oh, watch this. I've heard him do this is his whole set now. I'm going to fuck him over by getting him to do an encore." And we all were going, "Oh, dickhead." And he went on encore, Robin went on again. And honestly,
and then went out to watch it. What a dickhead. Let's go and watch this.
He must have encored Robin about six times going, fuck. "This guy's got nothing more." Robin probably did over an hour. He could have just kept going up all night. But I think people's attention spans change as well because they want to go on their phone.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I do think people don't want an encore. They want to go out and do their thing.
It's funny. It's funny. Some acts try and set an encore up, don't they? Like, "Oh, I've got to go now, unfortunately," just to try and get them to go. Yeah. No more.
Used to be a tactic. That used to be a definite for an act that was trying to establish themselves. Because if you could get in with the Glee Club and Up the Creek, say, if you got in with them, when you rang other people, you didn't used to have to do an open spot. You used to just be able to go, "Oh, I'm doing gigs for the Banana. I'm doing gigs for..."
Oh, okay, yeah.
You name the big clubs and the weir clubs would take you. So you would often see that somebody that was lower down the bell was trying to do an encore, that it would fucking, you know, it does ruin the night, doesn't it? If it lowered down the bell act, doesn't
it? In my years of comparing, I've given a couple of encores to acts like when I've genuinely felt like, this crowd, you know, have been amazing. They genuinely want it.
Let's bring Julian back on. But I've
gigged with a few names in particular I can think of where they've tried to engineer an encore and the crowd probably would have gone for it, and I've just, as the compere, just actively made sure it doesn't happen. not to be a cunt, but just because I'm like, no, because that's a fake encore. You don't get it.
You don't get to,
they literally were halfway through a routine when they got a light. They could have finished the routine in 2 minutes, go over a minute, right? But they've gone, "Oh, guys, sorry, got to go. I'd love to have finished that bit and done some more, but I can't."
I'll tell you the end of the mystery at the end of the story.
And they've ended up doing an extra minute, like telling the audience how they can't do the end of the bit. And I'm like, no, fuck that. I've seen through this. So I've just gone on there at the side of the stage thinking they're going to get an encore. The crowd are calling for it. I'm going like, "Sorry, guys, that's all we got time for." See you later. Take it easy. And you can see they're furious, man.
Do an encore yourself.
Yeah. I do 5 minutes of just wrapping up.
you must have seen that. But when they go, I've had acts that go like that, that they go, "Will you get me an encore? Not will you give me an..." So honestly, only on a couple of occasions have I gone where there could have been an encore, have I killed that, mostly because I needed to drive home or something.
Yeah, there's that as well.
And it's over, you know. And also when it's fucking over, do you know what
I mean?
But I've had that when acts have gone, "Can you like organize me an encore?" And you're kind of going, No. If you make an encore happen, I'll give you, I'll tell them about it. But yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's that thing, like, I think as a compere, I often think like acts put too much pressure on the compere. You know, I think as a compere, you're there just to make everyone happy, get them in a good mood, make sure you tell them where the breaks are, have a bit of a laugh, get the acts onto a nice feeling room. That's it. I don't think there's any other. I hate it when like acts try and put rules on you. Like, "Can you do a bit of material before you bring me on?" I was like, I'll do what I want to do before bringing you on. I'll make sure they're set up. You let me do my bit. You do your bit.
See, to be honest, I have a different approach. I think when I'm the compere, And so, you know, I normal life, I would be a resident compere at the stands, comedy clubs. And I literally go that I'm trying to raise the bar to make it really good.
Yeah.
And what I do is I do all them rules. But what I try to do is I try to do something that's ever so, that's my own thing.
Yeah.
But that's a little bit like what the person coming on is going to do. So I've given them a running start.
I like that. So just I don't ever say to someone, can you do material? But sometimes I will ask if they do. Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah,
and then I say, you know, it's totally up to them, obviously. But sometimes
I'm more mercenary than that, mate. I'll make sure they come onto a lovely feeling atmosphere, but I ain't doing material or nothing. I'll just do whatever's
Yeah.
And also, if they don't have a good gig, I will throw them under the bus when I come back on. So I've got no problems. If an act dies, and if an act has a bad gig, you have to.
If it's really bad, you can't.
The only time it's ever backfired was when I threw Lewis Schaefer under the bus after he had a bad gig at the King's Head of his own fault. You know, it was a nice night. He went on in a bad mood and sort of went on the attack, and they just turned on him and just went, "No, you're shit." Like. And then obviously I went out and I said, yeah, he was shit tonight. He was shit, guys. Oh. And I just sort of was honest because and then we had a bit of a ding dong. We're fine now. We get on. But
what did he say to you? How did you have a ding dong?
He accused me of setting up the gig wrong before him, like, because I was I had running bits of banter going in with the audience that had been going on all night. So I'd go back to them and have a little chat. And I brought him on, and he accused me of not setting it up. Like, it was that you couldn't fail. Every act before him, there'd been like three acts on, had fucking smashed it. And it was such a nice atmosphere. And he just went on in a bad mood and just didn't, he just did badly. And he said I should have done a bit of material, set the tone. I was like, mate, I set the tone as a funny night of comedy. Fucked it by having a bad gig.
If you're the compere and you've got them to like and trust you, you can't then go, like, for example, I never go, this next act coming on is a great act, unless I think they are.
Yeah, totally.
You know, this guy's a very good friend of mine. I never do that unless they are.
I've had people say that. Well, I'm like, we've never fucking met, mate.
You know that. You blanked me in the green room.
And I had an act one time. I had an act one time accuse me of ruining it for them after they finished. Because you have to be honest, because the audience saw it was shit. And I just did similar to you're saying, Carl. I just kind of went, that guy was shit, but you know, we all have a bad day at work. Maybe you'll see him again and it'll be good. I bet he feels bad about himself. Let's give him a big round of applause then.
Now he feels worse.
Afterwards he said to me, "You ruined that for me." And I said, "Why?" He said, "You told him I was shit." And I just said, "Only after you'd been shit."
I didn't bring you on.
Factually correct.
It's a funny one. Like, if it's a mate and they have a bad gig, then I'll go to town on them. Do you know what I mean? Mm.
Watching a mate. When they're good,
if they
have a bad gig. But if someone like an open spot bombs, it's hard.
Yeah, if it's an open spot and they've genuinely gone on in good intentions and it's not worked, I won't go on and go, "Oh shit." What I'll normally do is do that thing of going, "Right, guys, they were new." That shows that, you know, it's hard and that, you know, they're going to get better. Like, I'll always be nice to, but if it's somebody who has actively made it bad by turning on the audience or any of that business, then they're done, mate. They're going in a bin.
Did you ever do Up the Creek when Malcolm was the...
No, host? Just that was just before my time. Did,
no.
Oh, so oh, Malcolm shit. Hardy used to have a great thing where he would go, "Here comes your next act. He might be good, he might be shit." And then
PJ used to do that when...
I've got to go. I said we've got to finish at 1. It's now 5 past 1.
Cool. 5 past 1.
For the most middle-class reason ever, my Cardo order has arrived, so I've got to do all that. And that's why I said we've got to finish bang on 1, but actually we've overrun, because I was like, they're not here yet. And they've just pulled up on the driveway.
Okay, cool, man.
Getting good stuff.
But it's been really fun. It's been a very, very fun
episode.
It's
been lovely chatting with you, Martin.
Nice to see you guys.
Business. Yeah, you too. Where can people can find your Instagram? It's got exercise stuff on it.
Instagram for fitness. I've got an Instagram for mostly photographs of nature on my normal one. Yeah, I'm on all them things.
And it's just Martin Moore.
Just Martin Moore, M-O-R.
There we go. And Julian, right. Any business? We've got to thank our patrons for being patrons.
We'll thank all of our patrons. And thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time. Thanks, Martin. Sorry for the abrupt end, but a card has arrived.
We're actually changing the podcast.
I think you're a diet of AIDS.